But I always want to say, have you seen a new movie recently? It's not any more realistic. It's just different. My favorite example of this is go watch any action movie. When the fist fights start, which there will be fist fights, close your eyes and see if you can hear anything that might sound like knuckles hitting a jaw. Instead, you're going to hear something that sounds like a blackjack hitting furniture. You know, it is not realistic. It's just what we come to expect, and therefore you don't notice it. Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. You know, we started this podcast in July 2007, and today marks episode number 30, which means we've been averaging a little less than one a month. However, you may also notice that this is our second podcast this month, and I can go ahead and tell you now that we have another one in 2 weeks. So we've picked up the pace, and the only explanation I can have for that is that my co-conspirator, J. Robert Parks, and I have... Well, we felt like going to the movies lately. Always have, but lately we've also felt like sitting down and talking about them, which is a good thing. You know, that first episode in July 2007 was an interview with filmmaker Guy Maddin. And I like that interview a lot. And we've also featured lots of filmmaker interviews on this podcast from time to time. But I think my favorite episodes are the ones where we just talked about movies, either the work of a particular filmmaker or a couple of movies that didn't seem to have anything in common. But you know, whenever you start talking about why movies work the way they do, they're all connected. This is a conversation about, first, the new Sherlock Holmes movie. And then the second part, we're going to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, but also Gus Van Sant's notorious remake from the 1990s. What do these two have in common? What do these three movies have in common? I have no idea. Nothing. Nothing and everything.
Inspector Lestrade has issued a warrant for your arrest.
We'll see about that.
Dangerous. Reckless.
Save the bullets, Watson.
What was that about saving bullets?
Always nice to see you, Watson.
Whatever you thought you knew about Sherlock Holmes is about to go out the window.
There isn't any time to waste then.
Kill the dog. Again.
Sherlock Holmes.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
How are you?
Good.
Today we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of, well, one relatively new feature that's out on DVD, and then one much older film, but hopefully finding some interesting parallels. But let's start with the newer one, which is Sherlock Holmes. Last winter, you wrote this interesting piece for Pace Magazine, where you talked about how... our ideas of what Sherlock Holmes is didn't always actually match up with what Sir Arthur Conan Doyle had actually originally written, and how this new hyped up version that Guy Ritchie was doing might not be so far off from what Sherlock Holmes originally was. So now that you've seen the film, what do you think?
Yeah, that's true. I was writing that before I had seen the movie, and obviously it wasn't a review of the movie, but in the build up to the new movie, the trailer is really in your face, like any Guy Ritchie action movie would be. And it's not exactly what people think of when they think of Sherlock Holmes. And I kept seeing references to that in the press leading up to it. The studio itself called it a dynamic new portrayal of Sherlock Holmes. And the Hollywood Reporter, in their interview with Robert Downey Jr., said, since when is Watson attractive, or something like that?
Yeah.
And I think the date for that actually would be 1887, because if you actually go back and look at the text, there are a lot of things about Sherlock Holmes that people have forgotten or that didn't translate to some of the previous movies and TV shows. And it's true that the Guy Ritchie movie isn't necessarily totally faithful, but it is not so far off, like as you were just saying, as you might think. I mean, Holmes was a drug user. Mm. He isn't so much in the movie, actually. He's just sort of crazy disheveled all the time.
Yeah, although you get the sense that maybe there's some reasons for that of a you know, hallucinogenic nature of some kind.
Yeah, that might explain some things. But there was a lot of bare knuckle brawling in the stories, and they did use pistols, and that he did have this hand to hand combat technique that he used, baritsu, and he fought with sticks and he carried pistols, and he one time said that he crouched behind bushes to wait for this person to come out, and he had to grass him twice when he finally did come out, and so there's a lot of that sort of thing that people have forgotten, and also the stories were written as serials. Mm. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle tried to kill off Sherlock Holmes at one point, but then had to bring him back because he's so popular. So, you know, this sort of the things that we're used to nowadays and these sequels and movie franchises are not that different from what he was doing then. Mm. And as for how Watson looked, there are references in the text to how he looked. And he's never mentioned as being portly or dim-witted. He's he's a friend of Sherlock Holmes, so he has to be on his toes. But also the stories, when they were published, they had drawings with them. And so this is almost like a precursor precursor to comic books. Yeah. Mm. And so there are websites where you can actually look these up. And the pictures of Watson that were published contemporaneously with the stories look an awful lot like Jude Law.
Huh.
So not at all what you'd expect.
Huh. So now that you've seen the film, were you sort of happy with the adaptation?
I was sort of wanting to like it. I was predisposed to like it, and it isn't any, you know, it's no great film by any means. But I thought it was pretty fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I especially liked how he's sort of a thinking fighter. You know, he does this sort of fist fights, yeah. But early on in the movie, a couple of times they pause those to give us a chance to see what he's thinking,
yeah.
You know, and he runs through what he's going to do, and then he does. I really liked that, and I wish they would have done more like that later in the movie. Mm-hmm. They dropped that.
Yeah, it is strange that they drop it, because I think it's really effective, and I actually just watched this on DVD a couple weeks ago, and the friend and I, we were watching it together, we both commented that, oh, I wonder why they don't use that later in the film, because it's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, it's this this quiet pause in the middle of a crazy hectic movie where he's, you know, you get to hear the thinking character think, and
yep.
So that was a nice reinforcement of that. Yep. I also thought they were setting us up to have it not work later in the film, where he would run through these things of what's going to happen, and then he would start the steps and something wouldn't work exactly as he predicted, something like that, but no, it didn't happen. It all just becomes kind of normal. But I did like it, and this character Irene Adler is also in the stories, and they sort of picked up where the stories leave off. She's actually only in one, but she's mentioned many other times, and they referred directly to the story that she's in.
Okay.
In that story, at the end, there's a king who is going to sort of repay Holmes by giving him a ring that figured prominently in the story, and Holmes says, "Now you can keep the ring, but what I'd actually like is that picture of Irene that you have there in evening dress." And so he does take that, and they refer to that picture in the movie. She notices it in his disheveled apartment.
Oh, that's right.
And the movie is really extreme in how disheveled he is.
Yes.
There are some, I think cases in the stories where things were a little bit of a mess. And he's portrayed as someone who, between cases, is aimless in the stories, where in the movie he's just a complete...
Yeah,
really chaotic character, sort of more extreme. So that's you know.
Yeah, and I wondered if part of that in the movie was they do try to amplify the sense that Watson is moving on. You know, Watson is about to get married, and that seems to have thrown Holmes for a loop, and that he's not quite ready to lose his best friend to someone else, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, which he actually does get married in the stories too. So that's sort of funny how they've picked that up too, and it did seem to be kind of something difficult for Holmes to deal with.
Yeah. Unlike you, I was actually predisposed to not like this film just because I don't particularly like Guy Ritchie.
Me too, actually.
You know,
yeah.
And so, you know, when I heard that Guy Ritchie was doing this, as much as I like Robert Downey Jr., I was thinking, oh, why does it have to be Guy Ritchie to do this? But I found myself liking it quite a bit, particularly in that first half. I think the way it sets up the relationship between Holmes and Watson is really good. I think this is probably one of Jude Law's best roles. He's really good as the second banana. But yet, you know, who's, you know, good looking and dashing and brings a lot to the table himself. And so their interplay, I really liked, the villains, and there seem to be sort of multiple ones of them. But I like that too. It doesn't quite feel like a Bond film, which is what I was afraid it might. It feels like a Sherlock Holmes story in that sense of who's the real bad guy here. What's really going on? Who can't we trust? And those early scenes of Holmes fighting and, you know, the pausing to hear him sort of anticipate, oh, now if I do this, he'll do this, and then I can do this. I thought those were really clever. And so the fight scenes for me were much more controlled than Guy Ritchie typically is, where I've always felt like he just had a good sense of dialogue, but not a very good sense of space. Where in this film, I like how he uses space. I like the fight scenes, at least up until the end. And so there's a lot to like in the film. It loses a bit of steam for me towards the end, in part because it feels a little bit more like a James Bond movie when it turns out the villains want to rule the world. And I'm not going to give away too much with that, but that just seemed kind of silly to me. It was like, wait, why does he need to rule the world, or why would he want to do that? That doesn't seem like a 19th century notion at all. It feels like a sense of trying to make the movie bigger than it needs to be. Whereas kind of the virtues I liked in the film were some of the smaller ones. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is great, and the dialogue and the interplay between him and Jude Law, I think, is very strong. So for me, the movie loses a bit of steam at the end, but still quite a bit better than I expected it to be.
Yeah, they continue to rely on his powers of observation, you know, throughout the movie, which is good. It does have a few too many fights to me, and I kept lamenting the fact that everything has to turn into a fight and a chase. And again, you know, it's like, okay. And it's also funny how little difference there is between various action movie franchises that you'd think on paper would be totally different. Like the Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons stuff is not that far off from this Sherlock Holmes, where there's a lot of sort of occult stuff going on, which itself is not the hint of supernatural is not alien to the Sherlock Holmes world either. You know, the Hound of the Baskervilles was thought to be this ghostly dog, but of course Sherlock Holmes knows that isn't true. And in this movie, we know that there isn't really going to be any occult or any supernatural activity going on, despite the appearance of things. There's always a logical explanation.
yes. For me, that's been a bit of frustration I've had with a lot of action movies over the last 5 to 10 years, is this blurring of particularly how heroes have to be portrayed. I know a lot of people like the reboot of the Bond franchise, but I don't actually. And I don't because I don't feel that, I don't know why Bond needs to be like every other action hero where he has to go out and be a badass and kick ass. I kind of liked a cheesy Bond. I sort of liked a Bond that sort of would, you know, was more likely to raise his eyebrow than actually throw a punch. Because we have enough of those action heroes. I don't know why we need to turn Bond into one of those. And as much as I found your Paste article really interesting, because I was also irritated that they were making Holmes into another action hero, there is a bit of where as good as Robert Downey Jr. is, like you say, there's a bit too many fight scenes. There's a little bit too much like other action movies. And not that what is special to Holmes is lost, but it starts to blur lines of this action hero is not much different than this action hero.
Yeah, I think that's especially, it's especially important that Robert Downey Jr. plays this character the way he does, because if you just sort of subtracted his quirks and put someone else in there, I think it would really seem very similar to just any other action movie, which shows how much depends on him. And I was thinking a little bit about his detective, the way this type of detective as he's portrayed in the movie. A little bit like Columbo, who's sometimes bumbling, but then you realize not quite as bumbling as you thought. You know, Clouseau, except that he's actually smart.
Right.
And I even thought a little bit about the Elliot Gould character in The Long Goodbye.
Oh, sure.
Who's just sort of mumbling through the entire movie. and you have to listen harder to hear what Altman's catching with his microphone. And it's so funny. And Robert Downey Jr. is mumbling a lot too, but he's very articulate and very manic. So he doesn't really fit any of these others. And I can't quite think of any other detective quite like this one. Yeah. That's important in the movie.
I like the Columbo reference because I hadn't thought about that. Clearly Robert Downey Jr. is very different than that. But it just reminds me, it's hard to imagine anyone making Columbo today. I mean, it's hard to imagine Peter Falk being a leading man today.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, for me, Columbo is amazingly great TV. But that sort of standardization of what a hero has to be, both how he has to look and how he has to act. And, you know, I mean, it's impossible to imagine Peter Falk getting into a fist fight in Columbo. And so if they were going to remake that today, what would they do? I don't know. But clearly it would be different.
And, yeah.
But you're right. Robert Downey Jr. is really great for this role and just brings a lot of idiosyncrasy in a good way, you know, in the sense that there's something really unique about him. And that makes this character a much more interesting character than, standard action hero number one.
Well, and this Sherlock Holmes, as opposed to Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, takes advantage of the fact that he doesn't look like he has it all together.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes people, they leave the room and assume they've left him in his pile of junk. And as soon as they're gone, he races out the window and he's down, intercepting their next conversation or whatever, So he is able to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Columbo, I think, did the same thing.
Yes. Yes.
In a different way.
Yes. Yeah, he would come back into the door. One more thing.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. Something I don't understand. There's something else kind of interesting about the period of this movie that seems to be fascinating to Hollywood at the moment, and that's, this Victorian era. There was The Prestige and The Illusionist, and there are all these movies that sort of take place in this very mechanical era. It's almost like the mechanical era is more cinematic than the digital era.
Mm.
You know, we're using now the digital era to simulate the appearance of all these big gears and these rusty looking levers and things that Holmes can sort of look at and say, well, this works because this is connected to that and this is connected to that. You can't do that when you're looking at a computer disk or something that's sort of invisible to you.
Yeah, but your point though is well taken, that it's being recreated digitally. And very obviously so, obviously a green screen and pretty much the entire film. I was struck by this because just a couple months ago, not long before I watched Sherlock Holmes, I happened to be flipping channels and I caught a half hour of The Fellowship of the Ring, the Peter Jackson film from, which now seems like eternity ago. But what's amazing about that movie is how much of it is clearly filmed outdoors. With real trees and real, meadows or real whatever. And it seems weird. And it seems really strange to watch it now because it's not a green screen and it hasn't been overproduced. I mean, there's a real, there's a lack of detail in real life that is different. I'm not going to say it's better or worse, but it's very, very different. And so, to compare Fellowship of the Ring to, the hyper stylized aspects of Sherlock Holmes it's just a very different kind of movie making.
Yeah. Most of Sherlock Holmes takes place in a city in London. And so there are all these interiors and cityscapes that they can't shoot in London these days. It wouldn't be recognizable.
Yeah.
To that era. So, yeah.
But even still, I mean, you could recreate it in a way that made it look somehow true to life.
Yeah.
But, when they're having this big climactic fight scene on London Tower on the bridge, it's so clearly hyper real. It's so clearly over the top in the level of detail that you're looking at.
There's this very cliched shot too of like a pullback from a very high vantage point. This would have been shot with a helicopter, except that now they do it in a computer.
Yeah.
And it's so robotic that it's very, very smooth, and it's not. I think it's supposed to imply this grandeur or this like shock of, oh my goodness, look how high they are.
Right.
When it's point, it's like seeing a thousand robots running down a hill. It's like, oh, they copy and pasted that. It's not any big deal.
Yeah. I will say that for me in Sherlock Holmes, that level of artifice seemed to go somewhat with the story. The story itself is artificial. I mean, this in the sense of, I mean, the levels of intrigue in Sherlock Holmes is fairly overwhelming. It's like, wow, this is a very, very complicated conspiracy that's going on here. And so in that sense, I can sort of, put up isn't the right word. There was a part of the set design that I actually found enjoyable, or part of the CGI that I thought was actually kind of cool. But it is just a different kind of filmmaking and has a very different impact on the audience.
Yeah, the music too by Hans Zimmer has a kind of tactile earlier era feeling. You know, there's some sort of a harpsichord or something that has these very like percussive instruments are used a lot on the soundtrack and helped give that impression too, I think. But yeah, filmmaking changes. And that's another reason I wanted to talk about an old movie on this podcast, Psycho, the Alfred Hitchcock classic.
Yeah, it's you and I were talking, I don't know, a couple months ago, and we were talking a bit about Psycho. I show about 25 minutes of it in one of my classes, and I really enjoy exposing kids to that because a lot of them have never seen it. But you were talking in our earlier conversation about having seen the Gus Van Sant version and comparing, you know, Van Sant's color version to which was widely panned to Alfred Hitchcock's earlier one. Let's start there. How did you find the comparison between the new remake and the classic original?
Well, it's the sort of, I think some people, I was probably one of them, had the same reaction to this that some people had when they saw the Guy Ritchie trailer for Sherlock Holmes. Like, oh my, you know, what a what a travesty this is to trash this this original beloved thing. And then I, you know, I watched the 1998 remake recently and was really interested in it. I found it really fascinating. It's a virtually shot-for-shot remake. This is not like a typical remake. This is like he looked at the storyboard, looked at every piece of the original movie, and just basically recreated it with color film stock and modern-day actors and a new film camera and all of that. And so it's a really weird experience. It's not the kind of thing that you normally see. And I think because of that, it feels like an analysis of a movie. Mm. It doesn't feel like I think my original impression was that this was an attempt to bring Psycho to a young audience, and I thought that was ridiculous. Show them the real thing, you know. It's a movie that stands up. Psycho is pretty good.
Yes. although what's interesting, and we'll talk about this in a second, is younger audiences don't find it to be so. But I'll save that. But go ahead.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about it in a sec. But the weird thing about watching the remake is it doesn't work. It isn't scary in the parts that are supposed to be scary or suspenseful in the parts that are supposed to be suspenseful to me as someone who knows the original. But why? Mm-hmm. And that is a question that is really interesting to ask. And I can imagine that Gus Van Sant, as a cinephile, was asking this himself. He had the audacity to do this, but I don't think it was craven necessarily. Mm. I think it was I don't know what his motivations were, but I think it was a very interesting experiment. Yeah. And there are lots of reasons you could say that it doesn't work. Like, for example, the actor
Vince Vaughn
is not right for that character. But I say that knowing that Anthony Perkins was perfect for Psycho. And so this movie has the difficulty not of just trying to make a movie as good as Psycho, but to try to make that movie.
Yeah. And let me interrupt you. Do you think Vince Vaughn is not good? Like, why do you think he's not?
Well, because he's different.
Yeah.
That's part of what I'm saying is, I think that it has a higher bar in some ways because it has to recreate, you know, with new actors. But there's more to it than just that. I don't think it's just that. He doesn't, Anthony Perkins didn't seem menacing to anybody else because he was small, where Vince Vaughn is bigger than everyone else in the movie. And so this guy is dangerous in not just because of his mental state, but physically dangerous, you know? And that's really different from the original.
Absolutely it is. Yeah. That strikes me. And I haven't seen the remake, but just based on sort of what I know of it, I was thinking that, you know, just Vince Vaughn's size would work against him, you know, because the smallness of Anthony Perkins is really important to that, to the success of Psycho. It's really fascinating. The sequence I show is basically the 25 minutes leading up to the shower sequence. And so most of it is a long conversation between Anthony Perkins and Janet Leigh, sort of in one of this back room of the motel where he gives her something to eat and then they start talking. And it's an unbelievable scene, particularly if you've seen the movie already and you watch it again. The dialogue is really, really funny because there's all these sort of hidden ironic things that, you know, become much more understandable once you know what the actual movie is. But for me, one of the reasons I show it to my students is I'm trying to get them to notice how camera placement works, how where you set your camera will often determine how you understand someone, and how camera placement can work with lighting in that way. And so over the course of this conversation, which I think lasts probably about 15 minutes, it seems quite long, Basically, Hitchcock shifts his camera, at least for Perkins, three different times. One time it's a very objective shot, but then one time it's actually quite, he shifts the level down. So he's looking up at Perkins, who then suddenly seems much more menacing in a very strange way, because Perkins, it's shot in an angle. And so you actually get this profile with the light hitting Perkins' face in a really fascinating way. And then behind Perkins are these owls, or these stuffed birds.
Taxidermy.
These birds of prey. And as also these paintings of women in distress. And it's a fascinating moment, because he suddenly goes from being kind of mealy mouth and kind of, you know, small.
Lonely.
Lonely. Good. To being much more menacing. But then at the very end of the conversation, as Janet Leigh stands up and is about to leave, we get not exactly a point of view shot from her perspective, but the camera also stands up, and suddenly Anthony Perkins seems so small, so much like a little boy. He's asking her to stay a little bit longer. Can you stay a little longer? No, I'm really tired. I have to go. Oh, okay. Well, I'll see you off in the morning. Oh, it's going to be early. Oh, that's okay. I'll get up in the morning. And it's this really amazing shift that happens. But I don't think that would work with Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn just has too much of a presence in terms of his, you know, height, in terms of his physical bulk. It's that for me. I'm sort of guessing here, but that I would think would be a big change.
Yeah, it is also that we know this actor, and I don't think Anthony Perkins was as well known before Psycho at all.
Right.
Where we know that when Vince Vaughn is standing there, sort of awkwardly chewing his gum and watching the car sink into the pond. I don't know. He just doesn't. You know he's acting. You know he's someone standing there acting, and something about it is not quite right. It's almost like, I remember riding a roller coaster in Ohio that was a classic wooden roller coaster that had been restored and reopened, and they had replaced every piece of wood on this thing, but it was still the old, same old roller coaster.
Okay.
But is it really? I mean, it's like, if every single piece of this thing has been replaced, is it the same? I don't know. It's similar to what Gus Van Sant has done with this movie. There's also the fact that it's in color, which you mentioned already. And that gives it a really different feeling. I don't know why he did that, because that's a huge change to the movie. It makes it feel very new and current and just different in some way. It's hard to explain exactly what black and white does to our brains when we're watching it, but it's certainly different from color.
Yeah.
And it colors the whole movie.
Yeah. I wonder. I mean, there's two reasons. I'm tempted to sort of try to go into Van Sant's mind and imagine why he does it in color. But my guess is that modern audiences hate black and white.
And therefore modern studios hate black and white.
Well, that's exactly right. And so I'm sure there was tremendous pressure from the studio to do this in color. But I almost wonder if Van Sant did do it as an experiment. You know, it's like, what would you do if you did Psycho as a shot-for-shot remake, but did it in color? You know, And in that sense, it sounds like a fascinating, you know, a test case. I can only imagine that it's really different.
Well, yeah, Christopher Doyle shot this, and he's a great cinematographer whose work we love. And yet, you know, he had to approach this in a totally different way. He, instead of, you know, sitting down with his big notebook that I've heard he has and thinking up shots and colors and all these things, instead he's just looking at a template and trying to recreate it. Wondering how they did it, what they did, whether he has to adapt it now for color because it was done originally in black and white. Should the blood in the shower be red?
Right.
I mean, it seems like it has to be, but there's something artful about the gray of the black and white when you see that. You know, it's not disgusting. It's a weird sort of beauty.
it's true. Yeah, in a beautifully gross way. Are there any parts of the movie that you think work? I mean, the remake is like, oh, that was interesting. I like how that, what that did.
I can't think of anything that improved on the original. What do you think of Psycho, the original? Where does it fit in the pantheon of Hitchcock films?
Lower on the list. In part because I think it's dated somewhat. You know, particularly the ending where we have this sort of long explanation of why.
What is a psychopath?
That's right. I think even 5 years later, Hitchcock would have gotten rid of that. I don't think that has held up well at all. And once Janet Leigh leaves the film, there is, I think, it becomes less interesting. But that first, I don't know, hour and 15 minutes, I think is pretty fantastic. One of the fascinating things I mentioned to my students before that they don't actually take to this terribly well is they don't find it scary. They're so used to having people jumping out from behind, you know, closed doors or having, you know, someone scream in their face. And they're used to sort of modern day horror tropes. And so, you know, when you watch the shower sequence, it's fairly sedate up until the climactic moment. But like there's this amazing, the shower sequence, I think, is unbelievably brilliant. And I wish I'd always try to get my students to appreciate it. And I'm not sure they ever do. But the fact that when the monster, and I'll just sort of say that in case you haven't seen the movie, when the monster opens the door, it's completely quiet. There's no sound at all of that. And what's happened is Hitchcock has moved, the way the camera shoots Janet Leigh in the shower is it sort of revolves around her until at this moment you see her and then past her you see the door. And so when that door opens,
it's partially obscured by the shower curtain.
Right. It's partially obscured by the shower curtain. And you know, she doesn't see the door open and she doesn't hear the door open. And it's this really, I mean, I get chills sort of thinking about it now because it's such an unbelievable violation of her, just that door opening. And yet for my students, they find that very, not effective. And they just find it like, what's the big deal? Why don't we have the door creaking? Why don't we have something else? And it's like, no, it can't have that. And it's Hitchcock has set it up so it doesn't have that. We see it. She doesn't. We know it. She doesn't. And so, but I'm always not surprised anymore. I should say I'm always surprised, but I remember being very surprised initially, how my students just don't take to it. Because they don't, they're conditioned to think the scary movie is something else. But for me, that particularly that middle half hour is unbelievably great.
Yeah, for me, Hitchcock's greatest movie is Rear Window. Mm. And Vertigo also is is really good. And then below that, you have things that are just technical masterpieces, but for some reason don't speak to me on multiple levels the way Rear Window does. Yeah. You know, North by Northwest.
Yeah.
And I put Psycho in this group because it is so interesting. All the things that they tried to do, almost experimental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was made the same year as La Ventura.
Mm.
And in both movies, the main character disappears in a very early part of the film and is never found again later. And of course, one of them is considered a European, you know, art film, and the other was popular entertainment.
Yeah.
But Hitchcock's reputation has changed since then as people have gone back and reconsidered a lot of these movies thanks to French film critics.
That's right.
But often what I think you see is people appropriating Hitchcock's, the surface of what Hitchcock did, and then the term Hitchcockian gets slapped onto their film. I think of Disturbia, which borrowed some plot points from Rear Window.
Right.
And I didn't like Disturbia at all. And I sort of thought that that's what Gus Van Sant was sort of trying to do with Psycho until I saw it and realized he's really doing something completely different by really trying to examine and honor the original in some ways by showing that he himself can't make it. You know, it's kind of a funny, it's almost humble to try to do precisely what Hitchcock did and fail.
I think another reason why, the thing that I love about Hitchcock most, which I think for at least my students and I want to say younger audiences in general, is Hitchcock really implicates the audience in what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, Hitchcock was always very, very interested in the theme of voyeurism and how sort of sitting in a dark movie theater is really akin to spying on someone and peeking in on someone's window. But it really, I mean, that finds its sort of climax here in Psycho, particularly as we lead up to the shower scene with these really spectacular point of view shots of us. Anthony Perkins is sort of peeking through a little peephole as Janet Leigh undresses. And we see that, but then we also have the point of view shot of us doing, of us looking at Janet Leigh. And I think that idea of voyeurism and sort of implicating the audience like Hitchcock does makes modern audiences uncomfortable. They may not be able to articulate what makes them uncomfortable, but I think that was definitely part of what makes Psycho a great film.
Yeah. There's also the scene I mentioned where the car is sinking in the water. What he's done is he's trying to get rid of the car.
That's right.
He rolls it into the pond and it sinks very deliberately and gradually, and then it stops.
Yeah.
And there's a cut back to his face, and then there's a cut back to the water. And to your point, you have to ask yourself, what do you as a viewer want at that point? You want it to keep sinking.
Yeah, you do.
Why? Now you've identified. Now you are in the head of the killer.
No. And I remember when I saw Psycho for the first time, I saw it with an audience, which was, I'm very happy to. But it was amazing how many people laughed at that moment. Laughed at the fact that the car had stopped sinking.
Yeah.
Because I think they either consciously or subconsciously realized, I want that car to keep on sinking.
Yeah.
And the fact that it hasn't, what does that say about me? And there was sort of this nervous laughter that went through the audience at that point.
Yeah. Or there's a kind of a collective holding of breath.
And then
it starts again.
Yeah. That somehow our sympathies have shifted. Which is really, really spectacular on Hitchcock's part. Because the movie opens with Janet Leigh, and Janet Leigh, is trying to, she's having this affair with this guy who's a married man, and she wants to try to convince him to run away with her. And of course he's making all these excuses why he won't. But I mean, there's where our sympathies lie. Anthony Perkins doesn't come into view for, a half hour. And then somehow in some weird way, Hitchcock gets us to shift at least somewhat of our perspective. It's a remarkable film for all of its flaws.
Yeah, well, that theme is something he explored even further in Rear Window. I think it is the theme of Rear Window. It's all about who wanted this. You willed this to happen in some ways, this thing that happened, that this murder, potential murder that happened outside your window. You really wanted some adventure. Mm-hmm. And it's no accident that the way Jimmy Stewart sees these things is through the lens of a camera. He has this telephoto lens that helps him see things a little better. And even when Raymond Burr comes into his apartment at the end, he tries to fend him off with flashbulbs. It's this very camera-oriented view of the world. It's really cool.
It is, absolutely.
Talking about people not appreciating or not thinking the movie is scary, I think a lot of that has to do with just the way movie styles change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there's always room for something like Sherlock Holmes or something like these, like a more typical remake than this one, than the Psycho one. Because movie vernacular changes, people, they stumble over these things that happen in older movies because they can't see past them. Mm-hmm. And it always really pisses me off, actually, when I'm in an theater watching an old movie and people laugh at things because, oh, that's so obviously fake. They're so much better than this. They're so obviously fake, these old movies. But I always want to say, have you seen a new movie recently? It's not any more realistic. It's just different.
Yeah.
My favorite example of this is go watch any action movie. When the fist fights start, which there will be fist fights, close your eyes and see if you can hear anything that might sound like knuckles hitting a jaw.
Right.
Instead, you're going to hear something that sounds like a blackjack hitting furniture. Right. It is not realistic. Yeah. It's just what we come to expect, and therefore you don't notice it. And I think that's why movies like even The Passion of the Christ, this sounds like a crazy out of blue example, really touches people in a way that like a prior movies about the same thing didn't or don't anymore because they speak some other language. In other words, this movie is speaking in a different way that is more familiar to them.
Yeah. And that's certainly valid. I think my only, and I know you would agree with this, is my hope is that somehow as film critics or people who talk or teach about film is that you could get audiences to also appreciate other languages.
Absolutely.
In other words, other ways of doing something. And so when I sort of do this 25-minute sequence of Psycho, part of what I'm trying to do is to say, hey, notice these subtle things that you would otherwise overlook because we don't have that kind of subtlety in a modern day film. Notice how, we haven't mentioned Bernard Herrmann's score, which is, famous justifiably. But one of the things that I love about the score to Psycho is that sometimes it's really subtle. There's this moment, the third shift that takes place within the interview sequence. Suddenly we have this low bass rumble that comes in. That if you're not paying attention, you don't even notice it, but it's definitely there. Mm-hmm. And there's that sense of menace that starts to build because we have this very subtle bass. And it's funny to think about, what would it be like if we didn't have that? You know, but that's just part of the wonderful subtlety of you know, great old films.
Yeah.
Is that they don't have to bash you over the head.
Yeah.
They sort of do things that are, they know they can be just as effective even if we're not really paying attention.
Yeah. There's a, I have a favorite moment of, Douglas Sirk is this filmmaker who made, you know, these melodramas that are often called women's films. Or yeah. But they're so great.
Oh, yeah.
One of my favorites is Imitation of Life. Mm. And there's a point late in the movie where there's this mother talking to her daughter, and the mother gives this this really melodramatic speech, and then she turns her face right toward the camera in this super exaggerated, cliche-looking, melodramatic moment. And then her mom, or her daughter says, "Will you stop acting, mother?" And she yells at her and says, "You're always acting like this," and she suddenly cuts through this. Mm. And it's really interesting to watch with an audience, because then, after the first moments, after the mother says her thing, everyone sort of laughed in the theater where I saw it, because, oh, that's such old-fashioned acting. Mm. What they didn't realize is Douglas Sirk knew that even when he made this movie, and cuts through it with the very second part where the daughter even feels this is melodramatic in the story and says, "Will you stop that?
Yeah.
You've got to stop that."
Yeah, that's a great film. We should podcast about that sometime.
Oh, that's a great movie. Yeah. That's one of the minor good things about the movie.
Yes. I mean,
there are great things about that movie.
No, that's a nice example.
You know, this thing about the movie vernacular always interests me, that the movie style changes, and that therefore filmmakers working now, even when they admire filmmakers from a previous era, they sort of are forced to a lot of times use modern techniques. And I was thinking of this movie, The Illusionist. Did you see this with Edward Norton? Mm-hmm. There's a magician, and he does this amazing trick in the movie, and no one can figure it out. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's sort of disorienting about that movie is that this is Christopher Nolan. No, it's not Christopher Nolan. No, it's
not. You did The Prestige.
That's right. This came out at the same time.
I always get those confused too. But yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, it's clearly a digital effect when we're watching the movie. It's something otherworldly. Mm-hmm. And so it gives the impression when you're watching it of, you don't really know what is the universe of the movie that we're watching. Is it supernatural? Is he doing something crazy? Mm-hmm. And then late in the film, this is a bit of a spoiler, but late in the film it's revealed that it is not supernatural, it is a trick. Mm-hmm. And it's an illusion that he's doing for everyone. And why then did the director use such an elaborate means to show it to us, digital, just because he could, because everything's digital these days? Mm. But I like to think there's actually a good reason for it. Mm. It's because we need to feel the way the audience in that in the movie felt. Mm. If we just saw some sort of magic trick, we've seen them all. You know, this isn't new to us, like it might have been new to people in the Victorian era. We've seen every magic trick there is. Therefore, we're going to know it's some trick. Mm. So if they take it up to the next level, the movie has to lie to us a little bit in order to get us into the mindset of the people on the screen, a little bit like what Hitchcock did in Vertigo. Mm. Jimmy Stewart, again, has lost the love of his life, and he thinks he sees her in a restaurant. It's Ernie's in San Francisco, and he thinks he sees her. And it actually is played by Kim Novak when she's in the distance. And then it cuts to his face, and then it cuts to the woman as she walks closer, and it's a different actress.
Yeah.
Hitchcock had to lie to us a little bit to get us to feel the way the character felt.
Yeah. I love that film. I love Rear Window too, but I think Vertigo is probably my favorite.
Oh, no.
And I can watch Vertigo. Although I will say this, talking a little bit about seeing things with live audiences, I never really understood Rear Window until I actually saw it in a theater. Because you have to have a great sound system to really appreciate Rear Window. You have to, because so much of the sound design in that film is, I mean, you're right that a lot of it's visual. It's, you know, us looking through a camera, us looking, you know, being peeping Toms in a way. But it's hearing that courtyard and hearing what Jimmy Stewart is hearing that suddenly made the movie come alive to me. And suddenly I realize, oh, wait, this is a wholly different kind of film than what I had realized I was watching before. That's not true for all movies. And as home theater systems get better, then sometimes you can recreate a little bit of that. But that was a real defining moment for me is watching Rear Window for the first time in a theater.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. You can find us on iTunes if you type Plastic Podcast into the search box and we'll turn up. You can leave comments there if you like. You can also find us on the web at dailyplastic.com. That's our home on the web, and we're either daily or plastic. I'll let you decide which. You could also call our special hotline to leave a recorded message, for this podcast. However, to find the number, I'm going to ask you to go back to a previous podcast and find it there. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a discussion of another movie that has nothing in common with any of these except everything